me start me by very briefly giving you my testimony, telling you who I am as a believer. I was not raised in a Christian home. I would have probably said that I was a Christian, but I didn't know what that meant. And at the age of 14, I was a freshman in high school. Suddenly all that changed. My family started going to a church. It was an evangelical free church in Walnut Creek, California. There I heard the gospel for the first time. I don't know what I would have said if you had asked me before that what the gospel was. I think I would have said it something to do with Jesus and that you need to follow Jesus if you want to go to heaven. But that would have been about it. For the first time, I was hearing the elements of the gospel presented at the age of 14. I was probably definitely more accomplished in my sin life than I was in my grasp of what sin was. I didn't have a well-formed doctrine of sin. I thought of sin as being something that would offend God, but I really equated that with the things that offend me. So I really thought, if I am a good citizen, then I'm not offensive to me, so I wouldn't be offensive to God, and therefore I should go to heaven. For the first time I heard that, in fact, God's standard is quite a bit higher than my standard. He demands holiness of people, and we can't meet that standard. I knew that for the first time, that I couldn't meet that standard of holiness. But also for the first time, I heard that God the Father had sent His Son, Jesus, God the Son, to bear upon Himself, to take upon Himself the wrath of God the Father for the sins of people like me. And for the first time, that clicked and made sense. And I responded and professed faith and prayed in faith and didn't experience any, the heavens didn't open, I didn't hear the voices of angels, so at first I thought maybe nothing happened. I prayed multiple times, but in retrospect, decades later, looking back, I can see that something did happen, that I was on a trajectory that would have gone this way, and I was put on another trajectory. It didn't mean that I stopped sinning or that I became perfect in any way, but it meant that I wasn't living for myself anymore. I was living now as someone who saved, and the gospel became the center of my life. That's now true of my three kids and my wife, and so this is something, it's a truth that becomes the very core of who we are. I share that with you just so you know a little bit about who I am. I was actually in love with science before I was in love with Jesus. My dad worked for Dow Chemical Company. I was interested in physical sciences from a very early age, thought that I would become a scientist. Eventually moved toward the life sciences and became a molecular biologist. And I'm going to tell you just a little bit about the sort of work that I've done. But really, the spirit of the book that I wrote is to communicate things to non-scientists. And scientists are welcome to read it as well, of course. But I really felt as though the most powerful arguments are not technical arguments. They're common sense arguments. And I wanted to put forward in the book some of the most powerful common sense arguments that show anyone who's willing to track these arguments, that we are not cosmic accidents, that we were designed, that we are here for a purpose. And that's a very powerful start. That's not the whole thing. That's not the gospel. But it's a powerful start that gets you to the point where you need to go and look for the gospel which is presented in Scripture. So, I thought the title needed to be nuanced too. David had it as something like, "Why Darwinism is False." I changed it to "How to Reject Darwinism with Confidence." But I like a more positive take on it, which is this: how everyone knows deep down that God made us. And I say deep down because this idea that we are made, we're made by a personal God, is something that I think we all know, but we find ourselves repressing or suppressing, and that's true of everyone, I think, that there's a point in life where we suppress that truth, and then the Lord calls those whom He calls, and we stop suppressing. So this is an idea that's in Scripture. Romans 1 says, "For His invisible attributes, namely His eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made." So they, meaning people who suppress that, are without excuse. And as I was working on the book, I came across something that is a similar idea in the Wall Street Journal, of all places. And this is the words of Allison Gopnik, a UC Berkeley psychology professor. She wrote, "By elementary school age, children start to invoke an ultimate godlike designer to explain the complexity of the world around them. Even children brought up as atheists." So what she's saying here, she wasn't approving of this. She was saying this is a bad thing, so we need to start educating young kids. But she was saying by the age of 4, even children brought up in atheist homes, when they see a butterfly, they think of it as something made by a godlike designer. And that very much resonates with the Romans 1 idea, that we all see this, and to some degree we all suppress it, at least at some point in our lives. So, what I want to do is look at two pictures of reality. Here is a picture of reality in terms of creation that is taught by Scripture. That God is uncreated, He stands above everything, that He created the physical universe, and He created us. Okay? Now, there's an alternative picture of reality that is the textbook or the academic or the, you could call it scientific. I don't think it comes out of science, but it's the predominant view that is being taught by the scientific community. And that is that the physical universe created us, not God. Now, this is really tied to a philosophical position, which is not science, it's philosophy. And it's a philosophical position that's called materialism. Not materialism as in greedy acquisition of expensive things, but the belief that physical stuff is all there is, that there isn't anything other than physical stuff. And if there isn't anything other than physical stuff, and a materialist would take that to be true, then God doesn't exist. We are entirely physical, and God is a construct that we've come up in our physical existence. Now, there are people who accept that the physical universe made us, who are not atheists, who are theists, and they would say that God is still the top layer, that God created the physical universe, and the physical universe created us. So they would agree with these materialists in that second step, but they would put God over it. And that's possible. You can do that. I think that runs into problems with doctrine. But the biggest problem it runs into, I think, is that it paves the way for people to say, you really don't need that God top layer. If you're claiming that the physical universe created us, then our creator is explained just in terms of the periodic table of the elements, the laws of physics. You don't have to have God up there, which means those who want to remove God from being up there are given an easy way to do that. This idea was expressed, it's expressed by a number of atheists, and again, there are a number of people who are theists who accept evolution. I'm going to explain why the materialist view of evolution is false, and we can know that. In other words, this can't be true. It can't be true that the physical universe made us without God being above it. It can't be true that the physical universe, acting only in a material way, made us. So here is a famous atheist, Richard Dawkins, who makes this connection between Darwinism or materialism and atheism. He said, he wrote in The Blind Watchmaker, "Although atheism might have been logically tenable before Darwin, Darwin made it possible to be an intellectually fulfilled atheist." In other words, logically, you could have rejected the existence of God pre-Darwin. What Dawkins is saying is that would have left you with a problem of explaining where we came from. And Darwin gave an explanation of where we came from that doesn't require God. Therefore, Darwin made it possible to be an atheist and have the sort of satisfying explanation for where we came from that one needs to have in order to be intellectually fulfilled. That explanation turns out to be false. I'm going to give you two ways to know that it's false that don't require any technical expertise. So I think they're very powerful in that respect, and they can be powerful for your own thinking, but also powerful for sharing your thinking with others. First, let me talk about these two elements of Darwinism. One of them is the one that we're going to focus on and reject. But I want to point out that there's another element of Darwinism that I'm not specifically addressing. So the first of the two elements is Darwinism addresses the relatedness of life. By that I mean this tree of life that is one of Darwin's ideas that he published in The Origin of Species. This is a figure from The Origin of Species. And it's the idea that all living things descend from a universal common ancestor, that we share ancestry with not only the great apes, but with all animals and plants, mushrooms, bacteria. All of us descend from something way down here that branched off through an evolutionary process over billions of years to produce all modern species up at the top. That's the first idea, and that does have implications for Christian doctrine, don't get me wrong. But the implications are not as profound or as immediate as the second aspect of Darwinism, because Darwinism addresses not just the relatedness of life, but the cause of life. What is the adequate cause of life? How are we to explain life? And here, there are other atheists who make this connection between this aspect of Darwinism, Darwinism as causal explanation, and atheism. One is Graham Bell, whom I've met, is at McGill University. He wrote in a book called Selection that living complexity cannot be explained except through selection and does not require any other category of explanation whatsoever. In other words, if you understand the principles of Darwinism and you understand selection, you need no other explanation to explain us. A little bit more bluntly, this was put forward by David Barash, professor at University of Washington, again a professor of psychology there. He wrote, "The more we know of evolution, the more unavoidable is the conclusion that living things, including human beings, are produced by a natural, totally amoral process with no indication of a benevolent, controlling creator." And he gives this message to his undergraduate class every year and sort of preaches this atheism. It says, Darwinism means atheism, and not only atheism, but this nihilistic version of atheism where there is no moral grounding for anything, which is a scary message, but it's a message that he sees coming from Darwinism, and there is a logical connection there. So, we are not going to look at the relatedness of life, and I don't address that in my book. In other words, I'm not saying that evolution doesn't occur in the sense of progression of species. I personally am skeptical of that, and I do think that it causes doctrinal problems. There's a volume, a large volume, that Crossway Publishing put out a year ago called Theistic Evolution that has about 30 chapters. I have one chapter in it that does address the relatedness of life and is a critique of that. And I recommend that as a reference volume. It's 1,000 pages, so it's good nighttime reading. We're going to focus on this, and I want to give you two arguments, and I'm going to have to do this quickly because I want to have lots of time for questions and discussion afterward. One of the arguments against this materialist view is what I'll call an argument from introspection, and the other is an argument from observation or extrospection, but we don't use that word very often, so let's just say observation. So the argument from introspection. Let's approach this way. If we think about things that we have to have confidence in order to come to conclusions that are downstream. And I'm going to start with human thought. We have to have some confidence in human thought to do anything that we think. To come to any conclusion, we have to first believe that humans can think and come to conclusions, right? So human thought is something that we have to check off and say, I believe not that all human thought is valid, but that it's a valid exercise for humans to think because some of our thoughts can be valid. It's possible for us to think valid thoughts. So if we have some confidence in human thought, that is really a prerequisite for us to do science. Because if we have no confidence in human thought, there's no way we're going to do observations and think about it. And that's what science is. Going out and doing observations about the real world and then thinking about it and trying to make sense of the real world by thinking. If we have confidence, or some confidence in human thought as a valid exercise, then and only then can we have some confidence in science as a valid human endeavor, right? And if we've checked both of those off, then we can look at specific projects that scientists undertake to explain the natural world. So, we can have confidence in this project only if we have confidence in this and this. And again, that doesn't mean that we're saying all human thought is valid. We're simply saying that it's a good thing for humans to think, because it's possible for them to think validly. And we're not saying all scientific ideas are valid. We're just saying science is a good thing because it's possible to do it right. And then we have confidence in this being a valid exercise, explaining the natural world. So, let's look at how this can go wrong in the case of specific explanations. So we have the same structure. Human thought gives rise or undergirds science, which undergirds or gives rise to specific explanations. If we were to have a specific scientific explanation that refers back to human thought and invalidates it, we would have a self-defeating explanation. Because if this explanation that we come up with and we say this is a scientific explanation, blah, here it is, but when we think about that explanation, we come back and say, but that explanation, if it were true, undercuts our confidence in human thought. It means we can't have any confidence in human thought. If that were the case, then we could have no confidence in science, and we could have no confidence in the explanation itself. So if you see how this is an idea that, if we take it seriously, tells us that we shouldn't take it seriously. It's a self-contradictory idea. It's something that invalidates itself or defeats itself. Let me show you how materialism really ends up being just that. In the book, I have this sort of thought experiment where I say, pretend that you're in a brain imaging laboratory. You have all kinds of equipment attached to your scalp. And there's a scientist that is showing you images of your brain in real time. And suppose this is very sophisticated imaging that he or she can show you absolutely everything that's going on inside your head while you're thinking. This scientist can show you all the neurons crackling away as you're thinking. And suppose the scientist were to ask you the question, what do you mean when you use the word love? What do you mean by love? If you use this word love, what do you mean? And you could offer an explanation of what you mean by love, but the scientist says, no, I'm looking for something here inside your brain. What do you mean by love? And I want to show you that what you mean has to be something in here, because this is a material world. Everything that you're thinking is here. Thought is happening here. Your brain is a material thing, and I'm imaging all of it. So whatever you mean by love, it has to be found here, because there isn't anything but here, right, to a materialist. And you say, well, that's not what I mean when I say love. I don't mean an activated red portion in my frontal lobe, if that's what the scientist was offering as a definition for love or as a meaning for love. And the scientist could come back and say, well, let me be more specific. A specific, if we look at the neurons, which I'm imaging right now, as you think about love, there may be a synapse firing right now as you're thinking about love. Is that what you mean by love? Well, is that what you mean by love? No. So the idea is there anything conceivably that this scientist could put up on the screen showing that it's a physical thing, a process, or a structure in your skull that you would say, yes, that's what I mean by love? No. Shake your head. No. There is no such thing. Whatever this scientist puts up on the screen, it is not what you mean by love. Okay? And it may be the case, and you can conceive that science, it may be that when I'm pondering love, maybe that part of my brain gets activated, and maybe even you could narrow that down to specific neurons that are firing, or specific synapse that's active when I contemplate love or when I contemplate any other idea. But the thing is, this is not to be equated with the concept of love. The concept is what it is. If this is firing when I'm thinking of love, it's simply saying that there's a correlation, that this is in some way a physical thing that is firing in order for me to be contemplating. When I contemplate, this fires. So it's a correlation, not an identity. It's similar to language. That is this what you mean by love, if you're an English speaker? Well, no. That is a symbol that we use to represent what we mean by love. So love is this idea, this concept. This is something that we can represent physically, L-O-V-E. You can put ink on paper, or in this case, photons bouncing off a screen. That's not what we mean by love, and yet English speakers recognize that as a symbol that triggers us to think of the concept that we mean by love. But what we mean by love has to be a non-physical thing. It can't be something that someone can show you on a brain image, because that's not what we mean. So what we have from this thought experiment is we're forced to this picture of reality, that we're not denying that there's a physical thing. We're not denying that our brain is physical and that things are happening when we think. But we're saying, if thought is what we think it is, there has to be this realm above the physical. There has to be this conceptual realm. Because anytime you take the ideas that I'm thinking of and you try to make them be something in my brain, I will say, that's not what I mean. So if you're saying that love is a synapse firing, then I'm confused, because that's not what I think love is. And you end up reducing all thought to nonsense. In other words, if the scientist is saying, you don't know what you mean by these words, I'm telling you what they mean, there's something physical, then you have to say, if I don't know what I mean when I'm using words, then all of this is nonsense and I can't think. Because to think is to deal with meaning, to deal with concepts. So this is precisely this kind of argument. By claiming that our thoughts, that the immaterial realm, the realm of concept, does not exist, and everything that you're thinking is physical, that idea undercuts human thought entirely, because it's saying what you think you're doing when you're thinking is invalid. These things don't exist as concepts. Therefore, that whole train of reasoning that led to materialism, that led to this view of the brain and the rejection of mind, is undercut. A little bit heavy, but does it make a... Do you see how this is self-refuting idea? The moment you claim that everything in thought has no conceptual reality and there's only physical reality, you're saying to the one who's thinking, you're confused about absolutely everything, because you don't refer to these physical things. Nobody says love is a neuron crackling. They say love is something conceptual. So that is the sort of argument that anyone can make. It does require some thinking about it, doesn't it? But thankfully we can think, because we're not just machines. Let me give you now a second argument. This is the argument that I spend more time on in the book. This is an argument from observation. So this is more like science. And in the book, I introduce an idea called common science. And I argue that, really, from a very early age, we are all scientists, in that we are making observations of the physical world. We are making mental notes about our observations. We're building mental models. And then we work with these models and extend them and test them. So... if you play a sport, if you're learning to do, ride a bicycle at an early age, you're already building models. You're already testing these models in the real world and refining them. And that is really a scientific exercise. So we start off in life being scientists in that sense. You don't need to know math to do it. It's all done through common sense reasoning and through observation. What I want to show you is there is, if we go back to what Alison Gopnik wrote about, by elementary school age, children start to invoke an ultimate godlike designer to explain the complexity of the world around them. What we're saying, what she said, and what I agree with, is there is an intuition that kicks in early on, by 4 years of age or so, that allows people to look at certain things and say, that had to have been made. That can't be an accident. And I think it has to do with this idea of coincidence, that we have an innate ability to recognize coincidences that are too extreme to be believed, unbelievable coincidences. And when we see that, and you can see that from the age of 4, you know that someone had to have done the thing. It can't have just happened. And we can look at some examples to make this more concrete. Okay. A crumpled piece of red paper. If you came across this, I could say, that looks to me like the shape of an elephant's head. You have the big ears, the big head, and you have a trunk coming down here. And once I say that, I don't know if anyone thought that before I said it, but once I say that, you say, yeah, I can see that. But you can also believe that that's entirely a coincidence, right? That this was just a crumpled piece of paper, strewn on the floor. If you crumple a bunch, we could probably come up with something like this that we could imagine for any shape of a crumpled piece of paper. That, we're prepared to believe, is a coincidence. Whereas if you saw this, and suppose you had not seen how this was constructed, or you're a young child, a four-year-old, you've never seen an origami crane before, you come across this piece of red paper, you immediately know that somebody did something. It's not equivalent to this. Here, you know that someone has worked upon this. You can tell by the way that this is structured that someone has done something to this, and you recognize it as something that you want to do. So it's the very sort of thing where the four-year-old wants to learn how to do something, that the four-year-old is recognizing that is something that has, that requires knowledge in order to do. That's not the sort of thing that can happen by accident. What I want to do next is to consider whether we have this intuition. We jump to these ideas that certain things cannot be accidents. They had to be done by someone intelligent. Can we show that that intuition is actually correct, rigorously? And it turns out that you can, because there's a branch of mathematics that's connected to coincidence. It's the math of coincidences, probability. And this won't get very mathematical, don't worry. But I just want to show you with another example of coincidence how not only is the intuition there immediately, so you don't have to do math, but you can do math and show that the intuition is actually correct. And there's a sound basis for it. So in the book, I use alphabet soup as an illustration. So here's some alphabet soup. If you pour some alphabet soup and then look in the surface, you can probably find short words by grouping letters together that just happen to be there. Three-letter words are usually not too hard. There's C, and there's May. In both cases, you can believe that this is a coincidence, right? It's not spooky because it shows all the hallmarks of coincidence. It's sloppy. You have to do a little bit of work. To see May, the letters are, the A's upside down. It's not neat or tidy. You can easily believe that things like this just happen. A four-letter word, rose, but again, you have to do more work. So you can easily believe that this is a coincidence. No one thinks that it's spooky. Now, I gave this talk once and someone pointed out, holy here, which is spooky. It is whatever, but again, you can easily believe that these are coincidences. Whereas if you lifted the lid on a pot of alphabet soup and you saw this, you would know that it's not a coincidence. And the four-year-old would know the same thing. So what's going on here? We see it immediately. Is there a way to show? Not only we all agree that we see it, is there a way to show, yes, in fact, that's valid. That's a valid inference. And there is. And you can do very simple probability here. If we just superimpose a grid upon this, and we notice that there's something unusual. So there's 23, I think, 7 times 3 plus 2, 23 grid squares here. We notice that for 5 of them, there's something very unusual in that you have these letters lined up. And then for the other 18, there's something somewhat unusual in that they're cleared of pasta letters. So you have this cleared space, and then you have a five-letter word spelled out, which happens to relate to the letters themselves, saying pasta. So we can do a very simple calculation. It doesn't have to be accurate. The numbers don't have to be perfect, but you'll get the idea. We have 18 squares that are unusual in this sense. They're cleared of pasta, and what I'm guessing is if you look at the rest of the surface of this soup, this is unusual to the tune of about 1 in 10, at least. In other words, you'd have to look over more than 10 squares of this to find something that just by accident was cleared to that degree. It looks like it's even more extreme than 1 in 10. But if we say 18 squares are 1 in 10 unusual, and then the 5 squares that have the letters P-A-S-T-A are more like 1 in 100 unusual, then this whole pattern is 1 in 10 to the 18th power, that's for the cleared squares, times 100, that's for the letter squares to the fifth power unusual, which, if you can do the mental math very quickly, is 1 in 10 octillion unusual. So the whole thing becomes extraordinarily unusual, and we got there simply by seeing that there's lots of things that are mildly unusual that all cohere. So when all these somewhat unusual things come together and do something big, that's what triggers in us the idea that the intuition that this cannot be an accident, that someone has to have done this. It's really the same thing for the origami crane. The reason the four-year-old looks at it immediately and knows that someone did it is you can see in the structure of it that there's lots of steps involved. If you've ever tried to fold an origami crane, you know that these are not highly probable. Even with instructions, it can be hard to fold an origami crane. So again, you have something, no calculator is required, because this is simply a case of seeing that there are lots of things that are somewhat unlikely, and they all come together in a way to produce something big. And that means that all those somewhat unlikelies multiply and give you a horrendously unlikely thing. Someone must have done this. Okay, in the book I talk about inventions as being a category that always has this property of lots and lots of unlikely things that are arranged in a coherent way so that when you look at the whole thing, you know that it can't have happened by accident. And here's a figure from the book where I show where we get the lots of small improbabilities. An invention is something that performs a high-level function, and it uses what I call functional coherence in order to do it. You have some high-level function, some structure that does a function up there in the top circle, and then it has components within components in it, all the way down to elementary constituents, the basic building blocks, that are all arranged in order for this top-level function to be performed. When you see something that has all these parts arranged, then you know all of these are somewhat improbable. It's improbable that these lower level things would be the way they are in order to produce that high level function just by chance. And when you multiply all these improbabilities, you get something that's extremely improbable to get the top level function. And this can be something as simple as a written sentence, right? In a written sentence, you have the top-level invention is the sentence with its meaning. Below that, you have word groupings that form the sentence. Below that, you have the words. And below that, at the bottom level, you have the letters that were arranged to make the words. So you if there were a sentence in an alphabet soup, you would know that someone arranged it, right? Because it's significantly improbable that any of those letters would be where they are in order to make words. Significantly improbable that words would be where they are in order to make phrases, to make sentences. So you know when you look at a thing that this thing had to have been done intentionally. Now, it turns out you don't actually have to see the parts down here for this to work intuitively. Whenever we see a function being performed that is a high-level function, it's nothing like what you get from the elementary constituents, then we know right away, even if we don't see what's happening inside, we know right away this has to have one of these clever arrangements. Because this wouldn't happen by chance, and therefore this has to be a constructed thing, an invented thing, a design thing. So here's a Canon power shot with a measly 4 megapixels back in the day. You would not have to take this apart to know that it can't happen by accident. You don't get this by jumbling plastic and metal bits together and shaking them around. And you know that simply because it's doing something that plastic and metal bits wouldn't do, and that is, you take a picture, you aim at a scene, you get the picture represented in pixels. Now, if you do take it apart, you'll see that, yes, there are all these parts that are cleverly arranged, but you don't have to do that in order for this inference to work. If that's true of the Canon PowerShot, it's all the more true of living things. And again, here, you don't have to take a physiology course to know that when you see things that perform at this level, that there's something very complex and very miraculous occurring on the inside, and that can't be an accident. But if you do take anatomy and physiology, you will see that confirmed, just as with the power shot, all the way down from organs to the tissues that make organs, to the cells that make the tissues, to the molecules within the cells. You see layer and layer and layer of this hierarchical complexity that's what I call functional coherence that justifies this intuition when we see the butterfly, when the four-year-old sees the butterfly, he or she knows that cannot be an accident because there's a lot going on in order for it to behave so unlike dirt or sand. The simple things don't behave the way the butterfly does. It's performing a very high-level function, and therefore it can't be an accident. Well, we have a 7:15 end, right? So I want to end soon so that we have plenty of time for Q&A. I want to tell you, briefly touch on the very low level of this is the single molecules of life, which is where I've actually spent my time doing the research, I and colleagues. And I wanted to give you a feel for how improbable things are, even at this very low level, where you have single chains of amino acids that fold up and perform functions within cells. What we did is to randomize chunks of these chains and see how hard it is to get a random chain that would fold up and do the functions that these things do inside cells. And we found out that even though you might not know, looking at a single molecule, whether that could be a coincidence or not, but it turns out when you study these, even these cannot be coincidences. Someone has constructed these, and you can show it. And we did that by looking at this particular enzyme. I won't go into the details because I want to get through this quickly. And a paper was published that came up with a probability of getting an enzyme like that to work by randomly putting together the links in the chain, the amino acids that form this chain that folds and performs a enzymatic function. I do a little illustration when I have a good ceiling, but black is not ideal because it uses lasers. I don't know if you can see a laser on this. Oh, you can. So I do an illustration that requires a volunteer. Can I have a volunteer who doesn't mind pointing a laser upward so you don't blind anyone? Yeah, you're being nudged. I saw that. Okay, so the idea is if there is a target up there on the ceiling, how hard is it to hit it by coincidence, which means blindly hit it? So I'm going to put a non-moving target on the ceiling. You're going to close your eyes, and there's a button laser, but make sure you don't direct it down. There's a button. We can't see it, I think. So close your eyes while I point this. First, I have to get my laser to stay on, all right, without... You're not looking, are you? It's a little bit hard on a black ceiling. It's not ideal, but... Okay, so the target is there. I see it anyway. Okay, so you can start just sweeping around blindly, because this is coincidence if you hit the target, and your dot is moving around on the ceiling. Not everyone can see it, probably. Okay. You would have to, I think you would agree with me, blindfolded, he would have to do this for a long time for the coincidence to happen. Okay, you can look now. The target is right over there. Yep, got it. See, once you're not blindfolded, you can do it. But it would take quite a coincidence for you to hit it. Thank you. Okay. So what would a comparable challenge be that represents the level of coincidence for finding an amino acid sequence that forms one of these folded functional proteins? What sort of laser dot would we have to have? What size laser dot and what size ceiling? Because what makes that hard is the relative size of those two things, right? The laser dot's small, the ceiling is large. One fixed laser dot on a big ceiling is a very small target, and it's going to take a long time for random chance to cause the two laser dots to coincide. Well, it turns out that the problem for the protein is a lot worse than this. Picture, for example, a pinhead-sized laser dot, and picture the largest ceiling in the world, which is up by where I live in Everett, Washington. This is the Boeing assembly plant where they put together the 737s. And it's the largest building in terms of volume, and I believe that means it has the largest ceiling of any building in the world. If you imagine clearing all the fuselages out and giving him a laser and me having one dot, you would spend I would guess a good chunk of your life, if you had to blindly wander around that building and hope that the two laser dots coincide, right? Why? Because the relative size of the dot to the space that has to be searched. That does not capture the difficulty for the protein chain. To understand the difficulty for the protein chain, we would have to have a hydrogen atom-sized laser dot. And the ceiling would be the size of the backdrop to the visible universe. Okay, there, I think we can all see that's not going to happen by chance. Someone has to do that. I think that covers the gist of what I wanted to say. So I think I will leave it there so we have plenty of time for discussion. So, and I can go back. I didn't see a lot of people, I get it, on the first one, so the introspection. We could go back to the introspection, or I could just field questions on both aspects of this. There is a way to be comfortable on both of these, that there's a simple way, you don't have to have science expertise to argue, in the case of the introspection, that when we think we are using concepts, and if you tell me my concepts don't exist and that what I thought was the number 3 is actually a neuron, then I have to tell you, if you're right, then I am totally confused. Because everything I think I'm saying and thinking about, you're telling me doesn't exist, then I can't think, and neither can you. So all of this is lost. And whatever line of reasoning brought you to think that we are nothing but machines has to be wrong, because once you think that and accept that, we lose the ability to think. So however you got there, you just undercut your own line of reasoning to get to materialism. That's the first argument. The second argument is that it would take an extreme coincidence, too extreme to be believed, in order to get high-level functional coherence, in order to get inventions, things that perform a high-level function by having organized layers of complexity below them. And Darwinism, or any other explanation that appeals to accidental causes to do that, amounts to a coincidence that is too improbable to be believed. And that's why you don't need a calculator, for the same reason you didn't need a calculator for the pasta spelled out in the alphabet soup. You saw immediately that couldn't have happened by accident. And what's happening, I think, is you're seeing there's lots of things that had to go right there, and none of them would go right by chance very often. So for all of them to go right, my chance is extremely improbable, and we shouldn't believe that. That's what the four-year-old is doing, and that turns out to be correct. There's a lot more I could say, but I want to leave plenty of time for us to dialogue on it. And do we have a roving mic, or do we want...
Go ahead, Mark. Speak loud, sorry. So first of all, thank you for giving this talk. I just have two kind of questions for you as regards to... both these methods seem like excellent ways to approach showing why we do not believe in something. How do we go from there to say with confidence what we do believe? Because these are negative proofs, in the sense that we can say that doesn't work because it's not, it's just coincidental, or that's very intentional. So that's kind of my first thought. How do we improve from just merely a negative statement to a positive statement? And then secondly, I was kind of wondering, like, in terms of the likelihood that you or I in our current form exists, you know, even though there's infinite possibilities, we still do exist. You know, whether you're talking about the 5 billion plus sperm release, you know, if one of them, just one of them reaches, that particular combination happens to be us. So it seems like that, by that reasoning, that we are highly unlikely beings as well, yet we, all of us, exist. So how do we not fall into that error when we're trying to describe the probability aspect of what does exist versus what could exist?
Yeah, very, very good questions. So, but we didn't get them on. Okay. So everyone heard what the questions are. Let me go to the first one first. I think the second argument, the argument from observation, you could say is negative in that it's showing you that accident can't be the explanation for this. But you could also flip that and say, there's really only two alternatives here. You either have accident or intent, right? So when you're saying that accident cannot be the explanation for this, when a four-year-old sees the origami crane, they're not just saying, that wasn't an accident. They're saying, my brother or my sister or somebody did that. Okay, so there's a positive aspect to it because there's only two sides to this coin. You could view it either way. Also, here, we're not simply saying, when we say, this is what it feels like to think, and this is what I think I'm doing when I think, and we go through this exercise of rejecting the idea that thought is simply a brain thing, we are not just saying that the materialist is wrong. We're saying that has to be there. That realm has to be real because our thought is grounded in that realm. So it's not just negative. It's saying that is there, and I'm not denying that this is here. I'm just saying if you say this is the only thing, you're wrong. You're undercutting your own idea, right? Now, very good question on the... have you followed the... Have you read Bill Dembski or anything on... Okay, so... if I were to write down a 20-digit number, or if we were to take... I have a 10-sided die, and if I were to roll that 20 times, I would, and we were to write down the digits, I would get a 20-digit number based on those die rolls. And that would be an extremely improbable number, 10 to the 20th power. It's a huge number. So, and yet we did it. We got a number. So is this the sort of reasoning that you're talking about?
Yeah.
How do we not fall into the trap of saying that just because this is improbable in that sense, it can't happen, when I can just take this die and do it? I can get a number, a 20-digit number. And Dembski would say the difference between the die roll and the butterfly is one of specification. So it's not enough that you say that this is improbable. You need to also say that it's been specified somehow in advance. So if I had that 10-sided die and you pick a 20-digit number, there's no way I'm going to roll it. Okay? So that's impossible. It's not impossible for me to roll 20 times. Now, I've actually... Dembski is right, and he's a friend of mine. Not that all friends of mine are right. I actually think this logic is simpler than small probability plus specification. I'm trying to find the figure from the book, which is not popping out at me right now. Where did it go? Oh, right here. Really, when you talk about functional coherence and this high-level function, that becomes the specification. I'm not simply saying that however you arrange letters, it's improbable. I'm saying it's improbable specifically to get a high-level function. And so it's not just... It would run into the trap if we're simply saying that all arrangements of letters on the alphabet soup are improbable. They are. But this is saying there's something special that we notice, and that is high-level function. And all cases of high-level function are extremely improbable, and they're special. And that's why they can't happen by accident. They're special and they're improbable. Does that answer your question? Now, but you're also talking about sperm and egg combination. It wouldn't be the case. I'm not saying humans are special in that sense, but there are things that happen in a scientific analysis would say it's random which sperm fertilizes the egg. You and I, if you're a Christian, I think as theists, we would say, scientifically, that's random, but I think God has his hand in all of these things. And that's really kind of a different line of argument. But it's the, how can God be sovereign and have his hand in all things and know all things, and yet there's a legitimate, scientifically legitimate notion of randomness. I think the two have to be held together, but it's perfectly legitimate for the sciences to say that was random, and for us to say, it was scientifically random, but I think there's someone above this who knows how this happens. Yeah. Good questions. Any other questions?
What kind of reaction did you have after you wrote that paper that was published on probability of proteins?
It was interesting because, so that came out in 2004, a while ago now. It was crickets from the expert community, then followed by a lot of sort of low-level critique, blog-type critique. So there's a blog website called Panda's Thumb. That's an evolutionary website defending evolutionary ideas. And there's a guy named Art Hunt, who's a biologist who's not in my area, who, after the paper came out, emailed me and said, I've been asked to write a review of your paper for this blog, for this website. Can you help me understand it? And so I helped him with the paper, and then he wrote the thing. Now, and that has taken off, and everyone who wants to say that the 2004 paper isn't valid cites this, something that goes back to Art Hunt, who wrote in 2005 this Panda something, and he had to ask me for how to interpret the paper. So it's a lot of not very high level critique, and it can get, you know, downright nasty on the web. But what's interesting is there has not been peer-reviewed, careful, serious scientific study that shows that, in fact, that result is wrong. And I actually know inside information of at least one case where there was a paper that was submitted to the Journal of Theoretical Biology that was specifically challenging that paper, my paper. And the editor had the good sense to send it to me for peer review, and I'm disclosing this. It's a blind process, but it's all in the past now. I was sent this manuscript for peer review, and other people were sent it as well. So I think it's a good choice on the editor's part to say, well, this is a critique of that person's work, so I'm going to get that person's feedback, and I'll get other feedback, and I know that guy's going to be biased because it's his paper, and he doesn't want it to be trashed, and if everyone else says this is solid, and he sounds like he's waffling, then I'll publish it. But the thing is that he did not understand the work. The guy did not understand the work. And so I wrote a critique in my referee report and sent it back to the journal. And I thought he had so misunderstood it that I thought probably the paper would be rejected. 2 months later, I got a second version, a revision back, again, for peer review. And I thought, well, they're going to publish this now, because usually you don't have someone revise a paper unless the editor is thinking, if you can get this in shape, I'll publish it. So I thought, this will probably be published, so I'm going to just say bullet points, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, what they did not get right. And it's fundamental that they didn't understand. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Sent that in, and I got a letter from the editor saying the paper was rejected. So the critique of the 2004 paper, to my knowledge, there is not a technical peer-reviewed critique that has stood, and there's been at least that one that did not stand peer review. But the gritching online goes on. Any other questions or comments? Or?
To echo Mark a little bit, you can put what you said in other terms in the sense of if you open the can of alphabet soup, the probability that any of those letters are there is astounding, in the sense that if you were to have chosen those beforehand, right?
Correct.
So in terms of the fine-tuning of the universe, the teleological argument of design is often critiqued when people say it's fine-tuned for the world we know now, right? Like, it's fine-tuned only in hindsight. But it could have gone on any process, and in any universe that was created, we could have looked back and said, oh, well, how incredibly fine-tuned this is. But your argument is that there needs to be some sort of specificity beforehand, recognized beforehand.
Right? Yeah, and that you may be referring to the anthropic argument in cosmology.
Okay.
I think you are. Deep down. So it's a really interesting idea. And the idea is this. I refer to it in the book as being kind of analogous to a autobiography of the genre I Live to Tell the Tale. Okay, so you can have these autobiographical sketches or essays or books where someone says, this happened to me, and you're thinking, there's no way you would have survived this. But you know as you're reading it, but you did, or I wouldn't be reading your book, right? You got to the end somehow, so something has to happen. Turn the page, find out what happened. However improbable it seems as you're reading it, in chapter 2 or halfway in, that this man or woman would escape what they're describing, you know they did, because they wrote the book that you're reading, and they wrote it after the thing happened. The anthropic argument is similar to that in this sense. What it says is, we know by the very fact that we're contemplating where how we got here, that we did get here, right? Or we wouldn't be contemplating. So we have to live in a universe where it's possible for us to be here. And the way this has been put forward in some cases, and Eugene Koonin is a biologist who's used this, who said, that actually solves the problem. If you couple that with an infinite multiverse and assume there's an infinite number of universes, then it doesn't matter how improbable, it does not matter what number you put on the improbability of getting a human being. If a human being can come about through purely physical mechanism, through just physics doing what physics does, and the probability is greater than zero, and there are an infinite number of universes, you should have an infinite number of universes where human beings popped out by accident. And it's an important enough idea. So what he said in his paper that was published, and he's the first biologist that I know who has appealed to an infinite multiverse to solve the problem of life, because he says in his paper, the origin of life is a conundrum that can't be solved because it's so improbable. But if we use this multiverse idea, infinite multiverse, we get infinite probabilistic resources, and the fact that we're here means we have to be in one of those very special universes, could be one in 10 to the millionth power, rare, but since there's an infinite number, there's an infinite number to win them out, and you get this very small fraction that has intelligence, and we have to be in that small fraction because we're intelligent and we're thinking. There's two problems with it, which I both mentioned in the book, both of which I mentioned in the book. One is that if you follow that logic, if it were true that humans are purely material things, and I've just shown you why it's not true, but if the periodic table can produce humans without God, and it can't, but if you grant that, then that explanation for us should, we should find ourselves, when we open our eyes and look at the world around us, in a bare-bones minimalist universe, in a bare-bones minimalist world where there's virtually nothing there except a brain that's thinking, because that's the only thing that we're forced to say has to be here, is a thinker has to be here because I'm thinking. So you should have nothing but a thinker, really. Whereas you open your eyes and look around planet Earth, you've got lots of things other than thinkers here. So it does not explain life. The other problem, which is even more fundamental, is this problem that, Darwinism doesn't work, and Koonin thought it did. So he thought you could leverage a multiverse to explain the first cell, and then evolution explained everything else. It doesn't. Even if you appeal to the multiverse to explain the first cell, Darwinism doesn't explain everything else. You have to explain this whole thing. And this whole thing, with all its richness, cannot be an accident. Because you wouldn't have a million species of beetle if the only reason we're here is that we're that very rare universe where a thinker popped out. You would just have the thinker that popped out and no beetles. But you have all of this. The other thing is, we cannot, as thinkers, be physical things. And that's what we show with the introspective argument. Koonin got that wrong. He believed, like most materialists, that what's happening here is thought, and there is no immaterial realm. There is no mind, there's just a brain. There has to be a mind and a brain. Good ideas.
Yeah. You faced a lot of challenges for believing in intelligence. Now, how would you encourage students who maybe are trafficking in the university setting, and this is totally antithetical to everything they learned in the classroom, and then actually be tempted to then kind of reconcile this with more of a theistic evolution? How would you encourage them as they walk through this and are tempted to maybe just fold up shop and buy into culture in this area?
Good question. So, and complicated. if you're studying the sciences, going that direction, I would recommend that you not challenge, that you just get your degrees. Do your work carefully, be outstanding, and don't try to argue against the textbook version, because you'll be given the textbook version and you need to master that. And I, my own kids, learn evolution, because it's the story of our culture, so you need to know the stories of our culture. You need to know why they don't work, but you need to know them so that you can be conversant in them. So the one thing I would say is don't, there's no point, it will serve no good purpose for a biology student or a pre-med student to pick fights with a faculty member because on evolution, it just won't. A better thing to do would be learn your stuff, do well, and then get to a position where you can actually do something that will make a difference. And that won't happen if you're picking fights along the way. You need to get through the system, get your position, and then at the right time, when you have the influence, you'll have an opportunity to make a difference. On the theistic evolution thing, we were talking about this. It's a complicated thing. Why do believers who don't have to accept Darwinism because they have an alternative, why do they sometimes accept it? And I won't pretend that I know for everyone. I think we should let people speak for themselves. But in some cases, it seems to me that these are scientists who are believers, and they find themselves in tension at church and at work. And at work, they have a science job. They're surrounded by people who know that they go to church on Sunday, and they're wondering what they believe about life. And they're worried, you go to church on Sunday, you're not one of these cranks who rejects evolution. And then at church, they can face sort of the opposite dynamic, where the people are worried about them because they're scientists. You don't believe that Darwinism thing. And so you can imagine people who find themselves in tension, and it's not a tension that they asked for, and they want some way to, they need some way to deal with it. And one way to deal with it would be to say, look, I don't want to argue science with the scientists. It's easier for me to just accept all the scientific claims, but then put God above it, as I did. So the physical universe created, yes, yeah, I'll buy that, but God made the physical universe in order to do that. So I'll put God above it. And that seems to solve problems in terms of friction at work. And then you still have the friction at church. And there, I think that is why we have such a strong push by this group, the BioLogos group, to try to get Christianity to sign up to Darwinism to sort of end this battle. And I think it's regrettable that that push has come at a time when Darwinism is weaker than it's ever been. It's already been refuted. We're simply waiting for the people who recognize that to get into position and change the way we think about biology. Yes?
I've taken biology class for years, so I'm not sure if this is something, but I know my teacher said that evolution, and she accepted like that we come from monkeys and stuff, but then she said that Darwinism and the Big Bang were on the way out. But she really stuck to the way she said the relationness of life, like the tree, the branches, tree of life type idea.
Okay, a biology teacher?
Yes.
Well, it's interesting that she said that Darwinism was on its way out. It actually is showing signs of being on its way out. I was at a conference in London that was put together by the Royal Society of London in November 2016, and it was called Evolution New Perspective, some sort of vague title. But what it really was a group of scientists who called themselves the Third Way, who were convening and trying to get momentum around sort of a movement to try to topple Darwinism and put something else in its place. But they call themselves the Third Way because the first and the second way are, well, maybe the first way is creationism, the second way is Darwinism, and they're saying, we don't want either of those. So help us find a third way. So they're non-Darwinian materialist naturalists who don't want God to be the answer, but they recognize, they're very smart, and they recognize that Darwinism has failed. So it's a very interesting meeting, and lots of sparks for this. Because there were some of the Darwinist old guard in the meeting, and they said, you guys are making a lot of steam about nothing. All of this fits very well under the Darwinian umbrella. And it doesn't. And a lot of the bright biologists are recognizing it. That might be what she was referring to, but there's a lot of talk about how we're really in a post-Darwinian version of biology. The problem is no one has come up with a naturalistic replacement for Darwinism, and there isn't going to be one. There isn't going to be one. They all run into this coincidence problem. There was a second element to what you asked. Is that?
I have like a lot of little questions
that I can't remember. I thought there was a point two that I didn't get to.
Let's do one more question.
Yes.
You mentioned a scientist, I don't remember his name, who was using the infinite multiverse to explain the first cell. And I also remember reading Stephen Hawking's book, The Grand Design. I think he makes a similar argument about the infinite multiverse, and his explanation is sort of gravity exists. And I was wondering if you could comment why we don't necessarily need to be afraid of those conclusions, because there's a sense in which Hawking can't prove gravity before the existence of the universe. So there's a sense of his faith being placed in that presupposition, in the same way he would accuse believers or Christians of a presuppositional belief. Can you comment on that at all? Has that made any sense?
Yeah, Hawking is quoted as saying something like, because there's gravity, we must...
Because
there's gravity, we were made from nothing, or something
yes.
like that. So is that nonsensical?
Yeah.
What Hawking would have done, the late Stephen Hawking, would have done is just accepted the Darwinian view and not argue with that. And he's a cosmologist, was a cosmologist. So he would just be trying to do dutifully his part of the whole naturalistic project, which is to help get the scientific community out of this quagmire regarding the origin of the universe. And let me backtrack a little bit on Big Bang, because there are a lot of Christians who think the Big Bang is a problem for Christianity. Really, if you go back to the mid-20th century when Big Bang theory, not the TV show, when the theory was being put forward, it was a gulf moment for the scientific community, because prior to that was the steady-state model of the universe, where they argued that the universe has always been. So, in the beginning was the universe, and it was just like this. Suddenly, they realized it hasn't always been. It's expanding, and if you play the tape backward, it was a point. It had a beginning. So, in the beginning became a reality that the cosmologists had to deal with, and they knew right away, this is playing into the hands of the people of faith, and we don't like this one bit. But they could not deny it. So we're seeing sort of the, there was all kinds of wrangling over that, and what we're seeing now in the multiverse gameplay is a desperate attempt to get out of that problem for atheists. They could not explain the beginning of the universe, so now they're trying to back up and say, well, there's a physics that's pre-universe. But I think... not only is it the case that you must suppose something as your first cause, and all of these cosmologists, if they're saying there's a multiverse, they're saying there's some context that's real within which universes can pop up. Well, where did that come from? So there's something that you have to say is eternal, exists to eternity past. It's either this quantum foam, if you believe in that, or it's Almighty God. And so which is a more... if there is something that had to have always existed, which sounds more reasonable? That it was some quantum thing that why did it exist, or that it was God? So I think you always run into that problem. But we don't need to get caught up in the multiverse thing, thankfully, because there are these very sound ways to show, to bracket it and say, look, I don't know if there are other universes, but I know that doesn't explain why we're here. That's the way I would go about it. Thank you very much.